Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. When Oregon's medical marijuana program was initially set up, business, in fact commerce of any kind, was prohibited. Growers could not be reimbursed for expenses, they certainly couldn't be paid for their labor. Two initiatives that would have allowed grower reimbursements and even dispensaries, one in 2004, the second in 2010, were defeated at the polls. Following that 2010 measure's defeat, dispensaries started springing up all across the state. I should know, I ran one in Portland. The state legislature in 2013 passed a law to regulate medical marijuana businesses in the state. This is following the defeat the year before of the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, which would have legalized adult-use sales. A different adult-use legalization measure was voted on and approved in 2014. So the legal medical marijuana business in Oregon is only a little bit older than the legal adult social use marijuana business in the state. And they do still coexist. There is still an Oregon medical marijuana program. There's still a need for one. There were people out there, opponents, who claimed that medical marijuana was merely a stalking horse for legalization. And there have been some legalizers, admittedly, who also scoffed at medical. And all of them were wrong. Now, one of my good friends, Michael Kravitz, has been working tirelessly on medical marijuana for a long time now. I had the pleasure of speaking with him recently. According to his Wikipedia page, quote, Michael Kravitz is a U.S. Air Force veteran, executive director of the nonprofit Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access, and international advocate for cannabis policy reform with FAT Think and Do Tank, end quote. Now, although that information came from Wikipedia, I know those things are true because Mike Kravitz is also one of my good friends, and I have the great good fortune to have him on the line with me now. Hey, Mike.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's great to be here, Ty.
It's good to have you here, man. It's good to have you. Happy 2021 before we get started. Happy 2021.
Thank you.
So now, there is so much happening in the world of medical cannabis, it's kind of hard to decide where to start, but, you know, let's go with the international scene first, because there was a big change there, and moving forward, I think that's something that we really do need to understand. And you've been working with the Vienna and the New York NGO committees, you've been there at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and the World Health Organization meetings, you've been doing this, working this thing for years, so there is literally no one better to discuss this with than you. So what is going on internationally?
Well, you know, when I got out of high school, unlike my oldest sister, I had no intention of changing the world. That wasn't one of my, you know, bucket list things, to-do list. But nonetheless, that's what our team did. Quite a team is somewhat drawn from the elite of our cannabis movement worldwide. We've been working inside the United Nations under the, you know, sort of ad hoc moniker of the pro-cannabis team. And right at my side are Kenzie Rigoulet of Mouly and Farid Gayoche from France and Barcelona, respectively. And what we did and what we accomplished was nothing short of changing the international law as it pertains to cannabis as a medicine. And we have rolled back and eliminated and replaced the longstanding World Health Organization recommendations against using cannabis as a medicine, and have replaced them with robust instructions on how to use cannabis as a medicine. This is something that Russia didn't like, Nigeria didn't like, a lot of countries in their camp objected strongly to. One, you know, with the most extreme, craziest stuff that you could ever imagine, saying that if you would lower any of the, you know, kind of control on cannabis, then they're going to have trouble supporting their use of the death penalty. Of course, you got to keep death penalty on the table for cannabis. That was Indonesia, by the way. But this is the final culmination of 10 years of hard work. In the 2nd of December, the United Nations voted to accept the recommendations of the World Health Organization to change the classification of cannabis and remove it from the most dangerous drug list.
So now, what does this international rescheduling mean in terms of U.S. policy?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, if you look at the U.S. drug policy as sort of a house made of bricks on top of a house made of cards, you know, we've been working on punching those bricks for 50 years, and I just somehow found my way to the basement and pulled out a key card out from the foundation. Seriously, the United States of America, after Timothy Leary won his case in 69 and the U.S. federal law was thrown out as unconstitutional, they replaced it, as you know, history book stuff, with the Controlled Substances Act. And the Controlled Substances Act, purpose, implemented our obligations of this treaty that we signed in 1961 on the International Treaty on Drugs, so-called Single Convention on Narcotics. And ever since then, we've been hitched at the hip to this treaty. And it's funny because you would never really know this as a cannabis activist until you got way up there. You know, when you're in court fighting against the DEA, that's when all of a sudden the DEA tells the judge, well, no, we can't do that because of the treaty you're on. And it's just absolutely every single time that's the final brick wall that we get stuck at right before they, you know, they use their extreme power to just overrule the entire system, which is the other scenario in which we've lost. So, yeah, it's a phenomenal thing that right at the moment where we're changing command, we have a president that has expressed interest in, you know, changing the schedule of cannabis. We just broke the glass ceiling of where cannabis can be scheduled. Up till now, our attorney general, given this authority by the Controlled Substances Act of the United States, has deemed, based on our treaty obligations, that cannabis had to be in either Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. It's a matter of record. And now, as a matter of record, the treaty under which that decision was underpinned has been changed, and the attorney general will have to make a new determination. This will be a new attorney general that is probably one of the most fair people to ever make this, if we actually get the judge that is now, you know, in the nomination process to be attorney general to be attorney general.
Well, I will say I looked at part of his record, and of course he was there was a medical cannabis ruling that he ended up, or medical cannabis suit that he ended up rejecting, but it was on a very narrow interpretation of regulatory law, not about the merits of the case. It was simply that DEA's thing, and they said no, and that's the end of that, which was a cop out in a way. But it didn't really speak to how, you know, he didn't touch the question of whether medical cannabis, whether it should happen. He just went narrowly on the nothing I can do. That's just the way the law reads.
This is going to be really a case of interpreting the change in the treaty. I'll tell you this, our team has already sort of foretold in our estimation that the DEA will make a strong case that cannabis should not be in Schedule 2 based on the treaty change. But we would then counter with what? Of course, that was already an option on the table, that we already had this ceiling of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 before. The treaty was just changed in a substantive way. You mean to tell me that makes no change in U.S. policy? See what I mean? We got a pretty strong argument against the DEA's position that we expect. So I think that this will open it up to a discussion. A rational discussion. I think the end of that rational discussion is probably going to come to Schedule 3, which puts cannabis on par with the active ingredient in cannabis, perhaps Schedule 4. I don't really see, you know, it's just a matter of negotiations, us getting Schedule 5, and I don't think there's a really good argument for it to be taken out of Schedule based on the new classification in the treaty. So that's kind of the hard truth of the situation, but that's what I deal with.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Kravitz, a longtime drug policy reformer and director of the group Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. We'll have more in a moment. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Oregon Health Forum recently held a panel discussion on the upcoming Oregon legislative session. One of the items they discussed was the implementation of Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which was approved overwhelmingly in the 2020 general election. Here are Oregon State Representative Rob Noce and State Senator Deb Patterson, both Democrats. The question is posed by Becky Holtberg, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
Now that these ballot measures have passed, how is Oregon going to finance the necessary services to treat those who have been deferred? But essentially, how are we going to fund treatment now that we've passed these ballot measures that decriminalize some of these substances?
I'll start. So that's actually the big ballot measure 110 question. The measure actually says we're going to fund treatment by taking cannabis tax dollars that we're currently spending on schools and county services and fund it in the treatment space designed by ballot measure 110. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us legislators to examine that strategy and figure out if we can afford it or if the governor, maybe not a year delay in the implementation of that ballot measure, but if the governor has a little bit of a point about, like, we've got to figure out what we're currently funding with marijuana tax dollars, and do we need to continue that? So that's going to be the big, I think, question around ballot measure 110 is how do we implement it and pay for it at the same time? So a lot to come on that.
Yes, Senator Patterson.
I would like to add that there are some things, too, that are complementary to that that I think will help to address some of those issues. For example, the navigation centers for helping folks who are currently homeless, a number of whom have substance abuse issues. That funding was left on the table earlier this year, and I think that as we revisit that, it's coming back, that will also provide some funding that had already been built in. So,
all right. Go ahead.
A lot of maybe the growth on cannabis and marijuana taxes will help us cover the cost of that. For listeners that, read the Business Journal, that continues to be a growth industry. Oregonians are buying those products and paying those taxes, pretty significantly. So maybe we'll be able to sort of grow ourselves out of this problem. But for the moment, I think trying to figure that out is going to be one of our challenges.
That was Oregon State Senator Deb Patterson and State Representative Rob Noce. They appeared recently on a webinar sponsored by the Oregon Health Forum to discuss the upcoming legislative session. Welcome back. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you're listening to Free Culture Radio. Let's hear more from that interview with Michael Kravitz, Director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access.
I don't know if you want to put politics into this, but it's hard not to. As we're recording this, it's a week after the Capitol was attacked, the police were killed, and violent neo-Nazis carrying rebel flags running around shouting Trump slogans inside our Capitol. It's hard not to say something about it. Today, the president was impeached a second time. The Congress House voted to impeach him, and now it's off to the Senate for a trial if they should try to do so this time for real, because this is really scary. And the one thing that nobody said today that I just thought I would say is that, and it's just amazing, nobody said it, nobody thought it, I don't even know if anybody thought it, maybe they're not looking at it as real a threat as I am, but, they talked about the threat that President Trump poses very clearly. However, what about responsibility for a future act? Should the president do something horrible between now and a week from now, the House has done their diligence. They've done their job. If the Senate doesn't come in tomorrow and finish the process and take him out of office, and the next day he does something horrible that disgraces our country even further, causes even more loss of life because of his fill in the blank, I think that the House is going to be able to stand tall, stand proud, and say, they did their job. It was the Senate of the United States that holds the responsibility. And I would imagine that would be about the biggest cleaning of house that you've ever seen in U.S. history. Like, God forbid such a thing happens, but this guy, President Trump, is the most scary person in government I've ever seen in the United States in my life. And what happened last week was a disgrace. And he was most obviously the ringleader.
It's, yeah. I've said for the, I have seriously said for months that I thought it was going to all come down to noon on January 20th. The Marine Guards do their duty and escort, well, frog march him out the back door, because it, I doubt he really plans on leaving willingly, but then duty's their duty.
And, they have 150,000 photos to dig through of evidence. The U.S. Capitol has been cordoned off as a crime scene. Well, what many didn't realize was that using Facebook and you know, stuff like that, live streaming their crimes while they're, you know, breaking into and destroying Capitol property, which some of it is sterling treasures of the United States, you know, stuff made by our founding fathers by hand, you know, that's now been tear gassed and has to be carefully cleaned, you know. When they use their cell phone, the cell phone tower is downstairs inside the Capitol. Every single, you know, you're afraid of the big brother, big companies watching. This big company happened to be Big Brother. They actually just put their name right on the list when they turn on their cell phone inside the Capitol like that. It is 160 something like that open cases. It's clear that the law enforcement is taking this seriously. The army net now that has been brought together from the National Guards is now bigger around the Capitol than we have in Iraq. Yeah.
Oh,
I was just saying that that was basically in the sentence. I mean, think about that. Think about the fact that we now have a standing army protecting this inauguration. That's kind of mind-boggling. And you know, I'll say one more thing, if I could, one more second.
Oh, please.
The Republicans kept making, there was a lot of different arguments, and there was actually a couple of you know, kind of heartfelt pleas that you know, sounded pretty interesting and had some convincing details. But the overarching argument from the Republicans was that there's no time to impeach him. This would just be sort of to divide this country. Why would you even do this? Which, oh my God, you know, do they not remember the last two times we had something like that, where there was a Supreme Court judge that the President Obama couldn't put through because it was too close to his end of term, but yet President Trump put through a Supreme Court judge with half that amount of time just not that long ago. So this would be the third time in a short period of time that same issue came up of, oh, there's not enough time. And that completely, you know, evades the central issue, which is it doesn't matter about these last days. It matters that we've done everything we can to protect the country from the president, and it matters that he never, ever can run for office again, which would be the outcome of this successful impeachment.
Well, absolutely. It's it was horrifying. The images were just horrifying, and it's an outrage that. What divided the country? What divided the country was what happened on January 6th. And what's sad is that it in any way divided the country. I mean, oof.
I hear a lot of, you know, different conspiracy theories out there. Obviously, it's a crazy time for conspiracy theories. But, you know, this really isn't rocket science. I mean, if you go into a theater, I mean, this has been always the thing, right? Just like, you know, the basic medical necessity argument for marijuana. It was based on basic necessity argument, which is, remember what? You know, you steal a boat to save a drowning child. They're not going to arrest you for stealing the boat. That's a necessity argument. And, you know, everybody really probably already knows the basic, you know, freedom of speech line in the sand. What is it? A crowded movie theater. You can't stand up and start yelling fire when there's no imminent threat to the place actually burning down. If you're lying about that and people get hurt, then you're responsible for that damage. You're responsible for that injury. You're responsible for that crime of inciting that outcome. And President Trump has knowingly lied to the American people. I thought it was 20,000 times, I think, so far during his presidency. He broke every record imaginable. But this lie in particular, the lie that he could still win this election even after he lost was the most damaging. And it's the one that fueled the neo-Nazi hate groups like the Proud Boys to stand up and stand tall, or whatever their slogan was, that Trump rather obviously repeated by heart after quite a bit of preparation. It seemed like that was the thing that he prepared for in that, and I'm not being picking on him, honestly, that was obvious. Watch that whole debate, and that was the moment. He baited them into it carefully by saying, name them, who is it? Who is you talking about? And they said, well, what about the Proud Boys? Because, of course, it's the only, like, real name we know. And he was ready to say their slogan on national TV to tell them to stand up and stand ready. For what? To come storm the Capitol. He's a monster. He's a monster.
By the time this airs, he's a monster who's no longer occupying the White House, and will... Yeah, we'll see. I know that was the idea. Wait until the Senate was officially in the hands of the Democrats before running the actual trial. I don't know if that's... Well, I guess we'll find out in the next few days. The problem of doing an advance record, we don't get to find out what happens.
I can pretty much guess that the future is going to be, you know, this isn't going to be taken up by the Senate until the day before the inauguration, where they'll drag the process and hand it off to the next administration, or try to kill the process in one day. Either way, knock on wood that the president doesn't, you know, do something horrible between now and then, and we can just go on and not have the hugest stain on the Senate as already is, and it's bigger stain.
We can but hope and pray. And work for it. Mike, thank you for all the time, man. This is it's always good to hear from you. It's good to talk to you, and I'm glad that you're doing this stuff. Where do people keep up with you on the web and on social media?
Facebook is our place to hang out. It's funny, even on Facebook, you know, this discussion came up because of the president getting kicked off Facebook, and you know, people. The First Amendment and the protection of free speech is not to protect the president from the people. It's to protect the people from the president. Read it. Anyway, Facebook, we're still on there, even though we talk about marijuana and that's illegal. They've given us at least that much room, and we're still there. and find us there. But Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access, you can find us out on the web. And Veterans Action Council, like I said, a Facebook presence and on YouTube. Definitely look us up.
Well, absolutely excellent. And I, you know, yeah, you're still on social media, and I, you know, yeah, no, I am too. You know, in different organizations, where, you know, the drug policy reform organizations are, but we do have to be a little careful of what we say and what we do and what we have on there. I've run Google advertising accounts for nonprofits, and because of a drug mention in a Twitter feed, the account got briefly suspended. And then let's not even talk about the various people who have legal dispensaries who've had their Instagram accounts frozen or shut down, and their Facebook and other, and because, or that, you know, limitations on the things that they can talk about because of this whole federal nonsense. And
Doug, we have a much more systemic relationship with that as a cannabis movement. One of the instances that I would point to, of many that I could point to, would be National Normal. Of course, Normal, the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws, used to be repeal of marijuana laws, remember their old slogan, but they changed it to reform of marijuana laws, and they became more conservative. They raised an enormous amount. It was actually a Virginia activist that left Virginia Normal and went to join National Normal, and first thing she did was to get millions of people on her Facebook page. And when the president, that president was President Obama, set up a White House petition thing, the very first petition was on marijuana, and they got enough signatures to pass the petition threshold in 1 hour. And it made all kinds of news, and it was, you know, oh, it's rigged from the opposition and everything, and Facebook was embarrassed that this marijuana thing had enough clout to be able to do something like that, and they've stripped them of and not once, but I think twice, they've been knocked down to zero. So yeah, we get our rhetorical boxing gloves on, going back and forth with the system as a movement. We get knocked down, we stand back up, we don't cry about it.
Do you remember the during the Brian Eppes trial, the billboards that we were trying to arrange out in California for the trial, that "My Daddy's Not a Criminal" billboards and you couldn't they refused because it talked about the marijuana issue. Yes, because they were trying someone. The unfairness of these things, and sure. I mean, on the other hand, when that happened, it made a great news story. So, almost as good as having one of the darned billboards without having to be the schmuck who's paying for a billboard.
Yeah, Derek. So I'm burning to close this out with a thought. Right, we came from this movement to where Normal was having their first meeting in the 1970s with no kidding, Officer Stadenko on the other side of the wall, with a little microphone stuck to the wall at the conference center to try to hear what they were saying in their meetings to get intel on the marijuana movement. And we've gone from that to having, in just 1 week, our main champion in the Senate, Kamala Harris, Senator becoming Kamala Harris, Vice President, making all kinds of history and being the champion of the MORE Act that we were talking about before, the marijuana legalization package that is as bold as anything that's ever come down the pike. This is a very different world, and I'm really happy to be here. And if it wasn't for recent events, even with COVID, I'm pretty optimistic. But, these are tough times. I wish everybody well and much love, and hunker down, wear a mask, and see you on the other side.
Oh, Michael, it's so good to hear you, brother. I love you, man. You take good care of yourself, man. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
Have a good one, man.
Cheers. That was my interview with Michael Kravitz. He's a good friend, a longtime drug policy reformer, and director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. He's doing an event at the end of January for the nonprofit group Compassionate Oregon. You'll have to go to the Compassionate Oregon website for details about tickets. Because for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thank you to everyone out there who's fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. Many thanks to my guest, Michael Kravitz. A big thank you to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. The music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. Find Free Culture Radio on the web at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio is on Facebook at facebook.com/KBOO Free Culture Radio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.